Wayne, welcome back to Radio Times. Readers' online comments about news stories are designed to give the public a chance to respond, to offer a different point of view, to be part of a conversation. But many times, those comments devolve into name-calling. Is that just harmless venting, or do those nasty remarks have a negative effect? Our guest, Dietram Scheufele, and his colleagues set up an experiment to answer that question and is the co-author of an article titled Crude Comments and Concern, Online Incivility's Effect on Risk Perceptions of Emerging Technologies. Dietram Scheufele is a professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and the article appeared in the Journal of Computer-Mediated Communication. And Dietram Scheufele, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us what you wanted to explore in this particular experiment that you set up. What did you want to measure?
Well, what we were really interested in is how that new information environment that we all live in has changed how we interact with one another and with news, because we're really dealing with an environment where we're no longer sitting at the breakfast table by ourselves reading the newspaper and going through articles, but we see them online, and online we see them immediately surrounded by a whole bunch of commentary. Some of it is just Facebook likes, how often they've been retweeted. But other type of commentary is much more explicit, and those are the comments following them. So what we ended up doing is we ended up comparing what happens to people when they read the exact same article and when they see ultimately the exact same comments as far as content goes. The only thing that we manipulated across different experimental conditions was the idea of how polite those comments were and what they said. And what we found was, in many ways, from a cynical perspective, expected, but in many ways very, very surprising, and that is that people who were in the less civil condition, who were less polite with one another, also interpreted what they had just read about the technology very, very differently. So we told them about a new technology, nanotechnology, and its potential risks and benefits. And what we found is that the folks in the less civil and the less polite condition also transferred a lot of that uncivility to the technology itself when they thought about it and thought it was more risky and really interpreted what journalists had told them beforehand, and almost like they had read a different story, which they didn't. So it was really an unbelievably striking finding.
Well, and help us out. When you talk about the uncivil comments about this particular blog, I guess, or story, it was about something called Nano Silver. Give us an example of the, I guess, the rude comments that accompanied this article.
Sure. So the important part, again, is really that the comments talked about the exact same things. And Nano Silver is a nano-sized silver particle, so something 1 to 100 nanometers, the nanometer being a billionth of a meter, so something that most corporations are already using with lots of products on the market. And there's pluses and minuses. And so the comments would talk about the same pluses and minuses, but a rude comment would say, well, you're just completely wrong adding an ad hominem attack, you idiot, for instance. So it would simply add that element of rudeness that the other comment didn't have, even though they said the exact same thing, and that's what produced the really strong effects, was simply the tone with which we interact with one another online.
So tone really more than the actual content.
Absolutely. It's only tone, not at all the content.
And the idea is that everyone having read this article, half the people reading some positive comments about it, the others reading negative comments about it, that really led to very different perceptions about what that article was about?
That led to really different perceptions of how risky the technology was. That was the interesting thing. So they read the exact same article, and afterwards we asked them things like, you know, how risky do you think that technology is, and so on and so forth. And what we found is that people ended up being much more polarized in their perceptions of how risky that technology is, simply given how rude or how impolite the conversation was that they read afterwards. And that's really the fascinating part, that the interpretation of the news themselves has changed based on what the commentary afterwards mm-hmm. looks like.
And on the civil side, were they super duper polite?
They were fairly deliberatively polite, so it's not that they were, you know, praising each other for how great they were,
right?
But they simply didn't engage in name calling.
Now, this is obviously an article that has, and I don't read this magazine. I'm sorry to say, the Journal of Computer Mediated Communication. But are we also talking about a very specific, very technologically based audience here?
Now, what we're talking about, what we did is we did actually, the study was done in a national sample. So it was done with a random sample of Americans. And that random sample was assigned to experimental conditions. And then they were asked not to read a scientific study, but to actually read a blog post that we used a Canadian newspaper. We felt that didn't have any preconceived political affiliations with it, and simply a science news story, and said, you know, read this story. We didn't even tell people to read the comments in particular. They just accompanied the story very much like they would in reality, and so people really saw those comments in addition to the story, more or less. So it was a scenario that really tried to replicate how we all use news in an online environment as much as possible.
But what you seem to be saying, and I'd be curious whether we can extrapolate this to all stories, that really ad hominem attacks, calling people stupid and idiots, does change people's perceptions of a story.
I think that's a very good question, and my answer would be yes. In many ways, the fascinating part is that what we found, we actually found for a scientific story, one where it's not a matter of opinion, one where it's not a matter of political views or of religious views or many of the other things that dominate our discourse in politics. But these were really about facts. Where we said these are the pluses, these are the minuses as scientists describe them. And even the facts ended up being reinterpreted based on the nature of the comments. So if we extrapolate that to a political environment where we're already approaching issues, if that's the Affordable Care Act, if that's abortion, if that's gun control, with a lot of emotions, with a lot of ideological, religious value systems behind it, I think that effect would be even stronger. At least my guess would be that the effect is even stronger. The fascinating part is that it happens even for things that are really ultimately fact-based and exclusively fact-based, which is also why we picked nanotechnology in part as a topic, because it's one where people come to the situation with a fairly blank slate. Many people don't have a preconceived notion. Maybe most people don't really know what it's all about anyway. So that informational stimulus that we gave them really came from or was processed with a fairly blank slate.
But are you also saying that based on this research that news organizations and others should think about how they police their comments and getting rid of these ad hominem attacks?
So policing is a bad word in many ways, but I think you're absolutely right on the general premise, and that is we at least need to think about how we create better discourse. The idea, of course, you know, in many ways, American democracy is based on the idea of exchanging non-like-minded viewpoints, of hearing all the different sides, of being exposed to disagreement, debating it, deliberating it, and eventually making a good decision. And I think that value is an important one, and it's one that we want to maintain. But there's a key difference between how we interact with one another, even in a bar while we're talking about politics over a beer, when we have all the nonverbals, all the raised eyebrows, all the immediate feedback mechanisms that keep us from yelling at each other all the time, and online where very often we hide behind pseudonyms, very often we don't know who we're dealing with because it's an anonymous exchange of ideas, and where a lot of these social feedback mechanisms that we've developed over thousands and thousands of years in order to govern how we interact with one another are all of a sudden suspended. And so I think we have to come up with a new set of tools and a new set of agreements of how we govern these things, how we, and maybe policing is not that bad a word after all, and how we figure out how to interact with one another without some of those unintended side effects that I think we can all agree are not necessarily what we want. This is not about not disagreeing with one another. It's a question of how we disagree with one another in online settings.
Now, my final question, what's been the reader's response to your article about reader's response?
Well, it's been actually very funny. We wrote this up in the New York Times a few weeks back, and the comments section maxed out at 400 after about, I think, 20 hours or so. But we've also been called everything from dinosaurs to communists to everything else because of the article. So in many ways, that's ironically, of course, made exactly the point we were trying to make in our piece. So I guess we were onto something.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And that's Jeetram Scheufele. We've been talking about an article, an experiment that he did with some other scientists and wrote about it in the Journal of Computer-Mediated Communication. And the title of the article, Crude Comments and Concern. Joining us now is Megan Dawn, and she's an opinion columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Wrote a book called The Los Angeles Times, and the author of a book titled Life Would Be Perfect If I Lived in That House. And Megan Dawn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Bob Cohn, and he's editor of the Atlantic Digital, overseeing all the Atlantic monthly websites, joining us from their studios. And Bob, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you both here. Megan, let me go back to you because you wrote a piece in response to this article that was in the New York Times about this study saying essentially, yay, you know, someone's speaking my same language here.
Well, I felt that finally this experience we have been having for years had been quantified. It's very easy for us as journalists to complain about comments and the sort of instant reaction culture that has been going on for the past, 10, 15 years or so. But to have some sort of official data as to what kind of effects this is actually having on reader opinions was nice to see.
But did that confirm your suspicions that nasty negative effects really do impact how people absorb and understand something that you might have written?
I think it affects how some people absorb it, certainly. And, you know, I should just preface this by saying that as a columnist, as someone who's communicating with the public, getting nasty comments is kind of a good problem to have.
Right.
You know, it's a position of privilege. It means that people are reading what I write and caring enough to respond. That said, I think this phenomenon, this instant reaction sort of mentality that readers get into, which is epitomized by the online comments, can have a profound effect not only on the way readers read, but the way writers write. And that's something that I've been interested in recently.
And Bob Cohn, about a minute or so before our first break here, but I'd be curious about your response to this research.
Well, at an intellectual level, I find it fascinating. The study, the way it was set up, and the findings, I find very interesting. Journalistically, I think it's disturbing and even alarming that the comments that are part of the stories we and others write are actually affecting the way our readers understand the content. And if that's true, I think that's something to take seriously.
Well, and what was interesting is that sort of separating out the content of this experiment, Bob, but looking at the tone, I mean, the use of the word, you know, idiot. I mean, obviously no one wants to be called an idiot, but that seemed to influence people's perception of what was in that particular article.
Yeah, we've all known that those kinds of examples of incivility create a bad environment for reading. What I don't think we knew before this study is it actually affects the way our readers understand the underlying story. And I think there's a distinction between just an environment that's not as ideal as it might be and actually creating misimpressions around your content.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're actually examining online comments, the effects that they have on content and the conversation. And our guests are Bob Cohn, again, editor of the Atlantic Digital, joining us from their studios, and Megan Dawn. She's an opinion columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And we want to hear from you. Do you read the comments at the end of an article or a blog? Do you post responses yourself? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents Freedom Seder Revisited, Thursday, March 28th at 6:30 p.m., an evening of commemoration, stories, and a community celebration of freedom. Stories from community leaders and others. What does freedom mean to you? Inspired by the original 1969 Freedom Seder, when hundreds of people of all backgrounds gathered to celebrate freedom in the context of civil rights. Presented with Operation Understanding and PIFA. NMAJH.org.
Every year, the masses descend on Austin, Texas for South by Southwest. 6 days of tacos, beer, and cutting-edge music.
This week on Sound Opinions, we bring you the best of the South by Southwest Music Conference. We'll tell you which bands lived up to the hype and which acts are headed back to the woodshed.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Crystal Bowersox grew up with hard times, but her grit, grace, and talent made her a star on American Idol and beyond.
the struggles and tragedy and every moment that has led me to now, just I'm so grateful for.
Crystal Bowersox tells us about her new album, All That for This, next time on Tell Me More. Don't know why
you care for me. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. A recent study examined the effects of online comments on readers and found that nasty comments shape the opinion and even the reader's understanding of the information in this article. We talked with one of the researchers about this article and talking now with Megan Daum and Bob Cohn and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Bob, do you think of your job as editor of the Atlantic Digital as a policeman? Policing comments?
Well, we do try to make sure that the comments that we get are contributing to the overall positive experience of reading our sites, but it is sometimes you're not so much policeman, but you're, you know, maybe the catcher in the rye to make sure things don't go horribly wrong and to make sure that we do try to moderate out, at the very least, hateful comments and spam, which really does undermine the reading experience. There is a trade-off here. We will never make our comment fields completely a positive experience. So we ask ourselves periodically, we've done it recently, are the comments worth it? Do they add or subtract to the overall experience for our readers? And we believe that even in light of kind of the occasional negative experience, that comments are part of the content and they can be illuminating and enlightening and can add to the experience of reading our sites.
Going back to you, Megan, and as you said, as a columnist, you want response from your readers and from people online. Are there certain stories or pieces that you have written that has gotten more nasty response than others?
Well, there's comment bait. There are subjects that are reliably going to attract comments. Anything about Sarah Palin, anything about Obama, anything, I think I said this in the column, anything in which the words child-free and sanctimony appear within a few sentences of each other. I mean, you know, obviously there are issues that people tend to take personally. I think anything that is a cultural issue that has very, very personal roots with people, you're gonna trigger extreme reactions.
And what are some of the things that you've been called that you can say on the radio?
That I can say on the radio?
Yes.
Well, if you have a name like Megan Daum, you're going to be called Megan Dumb.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, you know, it really makes me feel young again, like in second grade, you know.
Is that right? You feel like you're back in elementary school?
There's an upside, sure. No, I mean, you know, and it varies, you know, from publication to publication. If you have a newspaper whose resources are such that you can't have a stable of live humans looking at those comments all the time, it's going to be a different sort of, there's going to be a different sort of feel to that comment thread as opposed to a place that has, you know, a staff for comment moderation.
And do you read all the comments about your pieces?
No, I try not to. I really try not to. I mean, you know, the thing about this is that what I have thought a lot about is the way this is affecting younger writers. I talk to young writers, and they often say they feel totally paralyzed when they go to write because it's like they're looking over their shoulder all the time. How are people going to react? And that's not something I dealt with when I was starting out 20 years ago.
Do you think that's a problem, Bob? Self-censorship for fear of what an anonymous member of the public might say?
You know what the internet gives you is real-time response to everything you do, whether it's data or whether it's comments, and there are certainly some downsides there. I think the flip side of younger writers being more cautious is I think they're much more thick-skinned, certainly than I was when I was their age. I suspect Megan was. They have learned to grow up in this world of kind of hurled insults and rough and tumble, and they roll with it much better than I would have in my 20s.
But Bob, do you have, you know, certain criteria where you draw the line as someone who works as an editor?
When it comes to the comment fields?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so we have an imperfect moderating system because we too don't have a stable of people standing by to moderate those comments, and yet we've decided to basically opened the floodgates and let them go. And so we urge our section, the writers of the pieces and the editors of the sections in which the piece ran, to go ahead and dip into the comments and moderate as need be. In any given night, I'll be home reading, and I'll pluck out a comment or two or three and moderate them out. But we don't have a perfect system, and we've got some interesting experiments going on that might make this might bring more kind of firepower to the problem. And we also rely on the vendor we use, which is a platform called Discuss. And the Discuss platform allows you as a user to present your comments by newest, oldest, or best. And if you choose best, which I believe is the default, then the only comments that show up, the comments that show up highest on the page are the ones that other readers have voted up.
Hmm.
So you tend to get the highest quality comments at the top of your comment field.
Well, and I know you're running a bit of an experiment with Ta-Nehisi Coates, right, Bob, who's been on he's been on everybody's show, but he's been on this show as well.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi is just terrific. One of our senior writers and very active with his community. So it is not atypical for Ta-Nehisi to write a post that's very short. He might even say at lunchtime, noontime, it's yours, and let the readers take over and have a discussion. And when he writes something substantive, he can get 500 comments in the first hour. And that is because Ta-Nehisi has kind of tended to his community so aggressively and so carefully over the years. About 6 months ago, Ta-Nehisi came to me and said, I really am now spending as much time moderating my comments as I am writing my posts. We agreed that was untenable, but we also did not want to end his robust comment section. So what we've done basically is gone to three or four of his more active commenters and members of the community, and we've turned them into moderators. We've basically crowdsourced the moderating and given them the keys to the back end of our site.
Wow.
And they are now moderating Ta-Nehisi's posts, Ta-Nehisi's columns, rather, his comment threads is what I mean to say. And we may invite them to get involved in the rest of the Atlanta because they're reliable and they care about creating a positive commenting kind of space.
So that's working. From your
so far, so good.
So
it's only been a couple of months, but it's working.
Does that appeal to you, Megan?
In
the world that you live in?
No. I have a stable of haters that comment almost every week, and you know they're sort of deeply invested in their dislike for me. I tend to think of them first when I think of my commenters. However, there are people who are very thoughtful and really do add a lot to the conversation. Would I want them sort of running a kind of sideshow to my column? I'm not sure about that. And newspaper readers are different from magazine readers. I think a lot of this is very publication specific. So, I think that's something that to take into consideration.
But do you find, and I think a lot of journalists feel this way, is that you can spend as much time, I guess, moderating what you have written as you are written. Do you feel divided like that, Megan?
No, I don't. I've been doing this column for 7.5 years, and I think in the beginning I read comments more often, and I was, like Bob said, I was a little more thin-skinned about it, and I think that now I kind of, if it's a column that I'm particularly invested in, I may look at the comments, but generally I don't. In terms of this whole subject, I'm kind of more interested in in the big picture. What this says about the way people are reading. I mean, when you go to read an opinion piece, the goal of the opinion writer is to have a reader kind of think alongside you. That's how I think of it. I'm inviting my reader to sort of go along with me as I consider different ideas. And part of that is that when they're finished reading the piece, you want them to kind of take a moment and take a breath and think about what they think. And if they are confronted with 500 comments that are going to completely override their own thoughts, that totally changes that experience.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Megan Daum, and she's an opinion columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Also with us is Bob Cohn, editor of the Atlantic Digital. And we are talking about readers' comments, and we're curious about whether you have left those comments, whether you read readers' comments, and what you make of them, especially if there are these ad hominem attacks. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bob, I was reading something about Facebook, and the person writing about it said that they thought that the comments on Facebook were more benign and perhaps even more civil. The idea that you have a bit of an identity on Facebook, whether it's your dog or not, but that helped people behave in a more civil way. Does that make sense to you?
I think that does make sense, and I think it's no doubt true because Facebook requires you to use your actual name. It's no doubt true that if you have to sign your name, if that's your handle when you're commenting, then you're going to get an environment that is more reader-friendly, fewer ad hominems. At The Atlantic, we made a decision. You can sign into our comment platform, which is Discuss, via Facebook. Uh-huh. And if you do that, then you're named. And you would then ask yourselves, why wouldn't we just require that as some others do? And a couple reasons we don't require that. One is that if you're signed in via Facebook, all of your comments on The Atlantic or The LA Times or anywhere else you might be writing show up in your Facebook feed, and you might not want that. You might choose to talk to The Atlantic readers differently than you talk to your Facebook friends. And another is, we can all imagine a handful of cases where the anonymity is beneficial and even important, whether it's a whistleblower or a dissident in China or someone who's trying to speak out but would get in trouble in the workplace. So we made the decision to allow you to register via Facebook or to register via Twitter or directly into Discuss, and those platforms do allow you to be anonymous. And obviously there's risk involved with that, but we weigh that risk against the cost of insisting on using your real name via a Facebook registration, and have decided to kind of open things up.
Megan, one of the things that you seem to be referring to is that the internet allows for spontaneous response, and it sounds like as you think of your column, you want to engage your readers, obviously, but give them a chance, or hopefully give them a chance to think about what it is that you've written. But it sounds like with the internet, you can just fire off your a comment right away, right when you finish reading the article.
Yeah, back in the day, if you wanted to respond to something that you read, you would write a letter to the editor, and you had to get out the typewriter and type it up and find a stamp and figure out where to send it and put it in the mail. And then if they were going to run it, an editor would probably call that letter writer and say, we're going to make these changes, whatever, and everything was very considered. And I'm certainly not advocating that we go back to that sort of time, and I'm not advocating that, people can't have a discussion. I think it's actually overall an extremely healthy thing. It's extremely necessary. But there's got to be some sort of happy medium between just spewing out first reactions and sort of competing with other commenters for kind of snarky in the realm of snarky discourse, and going back to the old, sending a letter to the editor. There's got to be something in the middle there, and I'm not here to suggest what that might be, but I can tell you as someone who was writing controversial, provocative pieces 20 years ago, when you had to write a letter to the editor to get angry about it, and I'm still doing that now, it's a very different kind of experience.
Bob, there's a local blogger here that I read, and he gets a lot of response to what he writes. But it tends to be about four or five people all fighting with each other. They're there every single day. They're having their own private conversation online. It's a curious kind of phenomenon, and I'm curious whether you see that at The Atlantic. Regulars.
Yeah, you do in some places. You might notice that a post went up an hour ago and has 50 comments. Where did that come from? And you realize it's the same three people talking back and forth. And you know, we will regularly shut down comments on a post after a while, not after an hour, but after a couple of days. Right. If it's going nowhere, we give our writers a lot of latitude and the section editors and urge them, and they take more or less enthusiasm for this, but urge them to jump in. Nothing stops a comment thread going off the rails than the writer jumping in and saying, hey, that's not what I said, that's right. not what I meant, and read closely, or thanks for your comment, I think we see things differently, check out this link to something I wrote last week, and that can certainly get everything back on track. Not always, but we do urge our writers to get in there and participate in the thread, engage, and go ahead and knock someone out of the thread. If they are hijacking the thread, if they are giving, if they are creating a negative experience, we have a lot of latitude to make sure that I'd like to believe, kind of in a romantic notion, that the comments are part of the content. I'm not that naive to think that they're as good as the content, but I'd like to believe they're an extension of the content. But in order to keep that from happening, what Megan sees, we do need to be in there and messing with it a little bit.
Well, let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Zach from Somerset, New Jersey. And Zach, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. So my question is, do platforms, whether they're newspapers, magazines, any organization that has like an online presence, do they have in the 21st century in 2013 an obligation to censor extremely hateful speech and offensive speech, or should they just let everything go? My second question is, I know that, for instance, a lot of politicians have Facebook groups, and sometimes people do what you might call trolling, and they'll write not necessarily offensive speech, but very antagonistic speech that doesn't contribute anything to the conversation over and over and over again. It's sort of hijack the discussion. And sometimes, these Facebook groups censor it. Sometimes they don't. What are your thoughts on trolls on the Internet who aren't writing necessarily hateful things, but are just unnecessarily antagonistic and are trying to sort of hijack the discussion?
Zach, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Almost up on our second break here. Bob, can I toss that back to you and Megan? I'd like to hear from you as well. Trolling.
We talk about whether publishers have an obligation, their levels of obligation, the journalistic obligation to try to make sure that on balance the comment threads add more than they detract, mm-hmm. or else they're not worth doing. There's also a more ethical and moral obligation when it gets to, you know, incivility. And then there's a legal obligation, I suspect, when you get to hate speech and insightful speech. The trolling that kind of hijacks a comment thread just creates a fundamentally negative experience, and it's within the publisher's latitude to shut that down by warning the writer to stay on message, or we're going to knock you out of the box on this one.
Megan, about 30 seconds. Your thoughts?
I think, again, this is an issue of resources. If the publication has the resources to really get in there and figure out who's a troll and who's not, that can be very useful. I mean, unfortunately, you have some publications that the only way they have of managing comments is a software program that's going to look for certain words, certain, you know, hate speech trigger words. And so if the troll manages to use other kinds of words, mm-hmm. then they're going to get in there. So it really depends on the kind of manpower you have to keep an eye on that stuff.
And that's Megan Daum. She's an opinion columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Also with us, Bob Cohn, editor of the Atlantic Digital. We are talking about readers' comments. We want your comments at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Chestnut Hill College School of Graduate Studies offers a variety of degree programs designed to take your education and career to the next level. That includes both doctoral and master's degree programs. Their dedication to learning can transform knowledge, skills, and experience into a meaningful and impactful career. Chestnut Hill College is holding an information session on Saturday, April 6th. Details and more online at chc.edu/visit. Chestnut Hill College is a proud supporter of WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ty Burr, author of Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. One of its subjects is what movie studios did to turn actors into stars. When Johnny Weissmuller was starring in the Tarzan movies, MGM paid off his wife to divorce him.
MGM wanted to promote him as a single guy, because for him to be married would have killed the fantasy.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Psychologist Robert Nassif's new book, Autism in the Family, delivers his personal narrative as a father of a grown autistic son, as well as a comprehensive view of autism throughout the lifespan. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, I'm joined by Nassif to discuss how families of autistic children cope and care together. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Journalists are used to receiving angry responses to their articles and commentary, but there's some growing frustration with readers' comments online where anonymous writers can spew hateful and insulting remarks, and conversations also often devolve, into name-calling. We're talking about all of this with Megan Daum and Bob Cohn, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what Clark from Kennett Square has to say. Clark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, have you ever heard of Godwin's Law? Has anybody involved in the conversation ever heard of Godwin's Law?
Go ahead, Clark. Tell us what it is.
I've heard of it.
Okay, but go ahead, Clark.
it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, and it was developed by a guy in the 1990s. Who said that given enough time, any online conversation generally degrades into that kind of name-calling and things like that. And basically, the way that he described it was that people start talking about other people being Nazis or being Hitler. And when you reach that point, you know the conversation has just gone totally off the rails.
Well, Bob Cohn, it sounds like not only do you know the law, but you probably live it to some degree.
Well, it is kind of out there as a there goes Godwin's law, or how quickly can one get to Godwin's law? It's one more example of the way that these comment threads can go wrong, and there's not much you can do other than moderate as best you can, set up these platforms so that the ones that are voted up most highly show up at the top. It's like the old mullet strategy. Put the good stuff up high and put the party in the back. Put the bad stuff, you know, messy stuff in the back. And
did you just say mullet strategy?
Yeah, there's an old phrase for it, originally used for user-generated content on the web.
Yeah.
Let's put the professional content, let's put Megan stuff and the Atlantic Writer stuff out in the front of the site and all that user-generated content in the back of the site, and that's the mullet strategy from like about 10 years ago, which is to feature the good stuff and let the right. mess happen on the back pages. The commenting can be done the same way if you have a system that lets people vote up or vote down the best comments and then reorder your comments based on what got the most votes.
Megan, you wrote about confrontation fantasies. Do you still have them? Do we have Megan? Whoops. Do we have Megan? No. Do we seem to have lost her? I heard a knowing smirk from you, Bob. Confrontation fantasies.
Yeah, I don't have any, but I can imagine poor Megan, who's writing about the most incendiary mm-hmm. issues all the time, whether it's gun control or women's choice or electoral politics. Those do bring out a lot of haters, and I guess I wouldn't mm-hmm. be surprised.
But do you think, Bob, that readers have a response? We know that journalists have a responsibility, whether they use it or not, is another issue. But do you think readers have a responsibility when they post their comments online?
I do. Yes, I can't. There's no recourse if they don't exercise that responsibility.
Right.
But one of the things you hope for is that if you maintain kind of an interesting, vibrant, intellectually honest space of journalism on your site, then you'll get that kind of response from your readers. I know that can be naive, and some sites just bring out the trolls. I see it all the time on other sites I go to. At The Atlantic, we've been luckier. We do get our share, but by and large, we were able to maintain a kind of mostly civil and value-added conversation in the commenting area. And I think if it weren't that case, then we might be considering other options.
Well, let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We lost Megan, but we'll get her back online as well. We're talking about readers' comments. We want to know whether you comment on news stories or stories that you read online, and if you read them as well, and what you make of them. 1-888-477-WHYY. We have, looks like, Marilyn from Elkton, Maryland. And Marilyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I was thinking about the fact that it is stifling for a reader who may want to leave a comment, but then you're putting yourself at risk. And I was wondering if either of your guests had looked at foreign websites. I just happen to be Canadian, so a lot of times I will look at maybe the same information and see how Canadians are responding to it. And, for example, one was a tragic mulatto, and it was so hateful, the comments that were being made in the U.S., but in Canada there were some points and they were well-reasoned. And even though I didn't agree with them, it was food for thought. So I was just wondering if they saw a national difference.
Well, that's interesting, Marilyn. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bob Cohen, have you looked at that? Do you think there are countrywide differences when it comes to online comments?
Yeah, I can't say I can respond to that with any real intelligence. I am on foreign websites all the time, but I have not really made a point of trying to glean whether their commenting threads are more or less civil than what you might find in the U.S.
But do you think we have become more rude or ruder, Bob?
Well, the barriers to, I mean, Megan raised this before, the barriers to entry to drop a comment to respond to a piece of journalism have just evaporated. So it is so easy to go directly from thought to mad typing to having it appear under a pseudonym or a handle that, yeah, I think that that brings out tends to, if you want to be rude, that certainly makes it easy to be rude. So there's no doubt that this kind of real-time anonymity, the combination of real-time response and the possibility of anonymity, creates an environment that can be nasty.
Well, and Megan described that, letters to the editor, which is you have to sit down, find a pen, write it out, find a stamp, mail it, and all of that, of course, is building in time to respond to a particular article. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but it's such a different process.
Well, those were good days, and we're clearly not going back there, but you certainly could imagine software that said, after you've written a comment, are you sure you want to post this? Or we will post this in 10 minutes, and we will send you an email to confirm you want it posted. You can imagine any kind of barriers that might make you have just a quick second thought. Maybe someone is making those kinds of platforms.
Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Kyle from Port Richmond in Philadelphia. Kyle, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to, I have a sort of a quick comment about, I consume an awful lot of media, and almost all of that media is online, where there's active comment thread. And as we self-select the media that we're consuming, and we're, selecting for media that is closer to our views, often dissenting views, because so much of the readership is of one orientation, are really rapidly quelled with ad hominem attacks and, just sort of shouting down. And I know a lot of websites that don't use ratings to increase comment visibility. They just use chronologic order.
Sure.
And I was wondering how can we move forward, how can we move forward consuming media that is, any dissenting view is going to get, you're going to get called a Nazi, and you're going to get called all sorts of things.
Well, Kyle, appreciate
by anonymous trolls.
Sure, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Bob, it seems that when it comes to media, broadly speaking, the people tend to seek out like-minded sites and writers and newspapers even.
I do think that Kyle raises really one of the most insidious problems facing journalism today, and it's really not about comment threads. It's about people gravitating toward media, newspapers, magazines, television shows, radio shows that have political that have ideologies with which you agree, and everyone's in their own tribe, and there aren't many places that are doing kind of just straight ahead, intellectually honest. Here's what our writer thinks about this topic, where the pieces themselves may not be non-ideological, but the overall site is non-ideological. And I do think that this is, unfortunate that so much of our media has aligned itself into political camps.
And that's Bob Cohn, editor of the Atlantic Digital. And we do have Megan Daum back. She's the LA Times opinion writer. And Megan, I don't know where you went, but I'm glad you came back. Thanks for...
Gone to the land of the trolls. They kidnapped me for a moment.
Yes, exactly. But we found you, and we're happy to have you back. But we only have about 5 or 6 minutes before we have to say goodbye. But I'm wondering, sort of looking forward, and it sounds like from your perspective, Megan, is in order to really manage these sites, you need people to do that. And as we know, newspapers and other news gatherers are cutting back. It's people have to do more with less. Do you see that as a problem going forward?
Yeah, of course it's a problem. And you know, I don't know if this is something that was raised while I was away for a few minutes, but you know, another thing that happens is that in terms of reporting and in terms of what happens with reporters in the newsroom, often sources don't want to talk, or they're hesitant to talk, because they know that there's a chance that commenters will make libelous statements, to you know, use the comment board as a way to refute reporting or statements from sources. I think we talk about comments a lot in terms of opinion pieces, because so much of what news has become is opinion based. But you know, there's a real substantive problem when it comes to reporting and you know, the dissemination of facts and the power of commenters to completely refute those facts with absolutely nothing behind it. So that's a real problem. And I think, you know, when that starts to happen more and more, I think we'll have no choice but to really look at this, because it's one thing to have a bunch of, you know, ankle biters and, you know, people bothering opinion journalists and making snarky comments on blogs and that kind of thing. But when it really starts to have an impact on facts and on reporting and what the public knows about what's going on in the world, it will have to be addressed in a serious way.
Do you see it that way, Bob Cohn? That people might be reluctant to actually even be interviewed and be featured in a piece for fear of that reader reaction?
I don't. I haven't had that experience that Megan is noting, that a source might be less inclined to talk to a reporter because of the existence of a nasty comment space. But it is the case that there's a big underdeveloped area of the law here, which Megan alluded to, which is whether publishers can be held liable for libelous comments in their comment threads. Certainly, the law does hold publishers accountable for libelous comments that are in letters to the editor. Those are carefully edited. When I say certainly, I'm pretty confident about that, although it could be state by state. But when it comes to comments made in your thread, it really comes down to the question of whether you at The Atlantic or The Los Angeles Times are considered a publisher of those comments, or you're simply kind of a third party enabling them. And there's underdeveloped law here, but would be very interesting for kind of the future of libel law.
Megan, have you ever felt threatened by a reader's comment?
I haven't been threatened by readers' comments. I get a lot of emails. I mean, the kind of side point to all of this is that we have our email addresses posted at the end of the pieces, depending on the publication. Not our personal emails, but, you know, an address that we can instantly receive the feedback. And, yeah, I have received some really astonishing and sometimes not directly threatening, but kind of scary comments from people, and you know, it's emails from people, and you know, sometimes I try to kind of, you know, reappropriate it by printing out the really nasty ones and putting it up on my refrigerator just to kind of defang it a bit. But you know, it gets a little. It's not so nice when you walk into your kitchen and your fridge is, you know, covered with nasty reader emails instead of you know, pictures of your nieces and nephews.
Indeed. Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller on. This is Kate from Morristown. Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
The problem, as I see it, is that in America, there's no tradition of debating as there is in England. We don't have debating societies where people of opposing views use logic and reason to support these views and discuss things. So we don't debate or discuss. We just shout each other down. I think that's the problem.
Do you see it that way, Bob?
Well, I'm all for more logic and reason, that's for sure.
But do you think it's in short supply in this country?
I think that people have a hair trigger for going right to the emotion. I don't know that whether that's unique to the United States, but I would love to see more logic and more reason and less emotion in our pages.
Kate, excuse me, Megan, I'm giving you the last word. Do you think we need to develop this tradition of debate?
I think we need to develop a tradition of accountability for everybody. Journalists, columnists, writers who publish, we are accountable for what we're saying. We've had an editor go over it. We have rewritten it many times. We are professionals. And to have to share a space with people who are sometimes given, if not as much, but more space than what we've taken up to write the article, people who are not standing by what they're saying in any way other than emotionally, that's a problem. We would be fired for what a lot of these commenters say. And yet, they persist.
Yeah. Well, we have to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Megan Dohm, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a LA Times opinion writer. Bob Cohn, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Editor of The Atlantic Digital. Both of our guests talking about readers' comments. Speaking of comments, go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can leave us comments. You can certainly send us an email. You can check us out on Facebook. Much there for you to discuss and discover. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Heather Brumfield is our intern for today. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss. Cohen, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's Voices in the Family.